Israeli forces opened the gates of its rainwater stores east of Gaza, allowing rainwater to flood large swaths of Palestinian land. The Palestinian Ministry of Agriculture said in a statement that the water drowned thousands of meters of agricultural lands and damaged wheat and other winter crops. This led to great financial losses for farmers.
Every year in this time, Israeli army opens the rainwater gates to flood our lands and destroy the crops. Israel also sprays harmful herbicides at our land, damaging all the farms and crops planted. These attempts aim at forcing us to leave this land. We stress that these attempts won't make us leave. We will remain here.
In violation of international standards, Israeli army also shoot at Palestinian farmers to push them off their lands and spray herbicides beside the buffer zone along the Gaza Strip, something directly affects the livelihood of Palestinians.
This is the second time in a month the Israeli army has opened its water gates and flooded our agricultural lands. All the winter crops are now destroyed here. This means a great financial loss for the farmers and even consumers. Our life as a farmer is under risk of being shot by Israeli army.
The Ministry of Agriculture says the move hampers transference of Gaza's main source of fruits and vegetables.
Over thousands of meters of our lands have been destroyed this time. Opening rainwater gates is a move by Israeli army to force us to leave our lands and damage the main food supply for Gaza. Drowning these crops will not only damage the planted crops, but also the lands.
Palestinians here say the living conditions have been deteriorating due to the Israeli blockade. They say Israel is now making the bad situation worse by damaging their agricultural lands and causing them financial losses. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
In the Rohingya refugee camp in the outskirts of New Delhi, there is an utter panic and the residents are fearful even going out to buy the essentials. They say many are chased, intimidated, and usually police and other agencies visit their camps to monitor their movements. Ali Johar, a young Rohingya refugee, says several have been arrested in the recent months and put into jails for illegally entering India, saying the whole community is in utter despair.
Around 60 people have been arrested in the different parts of India, including West Bengal, Manipur, Assam, Haryana, and Delhi. In Delhi, around 8 people were detained. In Haryana, several families were harassed to leave out from Haryana.
Fearful of possible arrest and expulsion, scores of refugees have gone into hiding across the Indian subcontinent, while others have entered Bangladesh amid a mounting hate campaign against the community in India. The destitute community, who has escaped what the United Nations described genocide, is struggling for existence amid international silence about their plight. An estimated 40,000 are living in India. The community has faced a brutal crackdown by the army in their country, such as rape, murder, child killings, arbitrary arrests, forced disappearances, as well as destruction of the entire Rohingya villages. Now many fear that the military coup might make the situation even worse. Some reports suggest hundreds of Rohingya are being held in Indian jails on charges of illegal entry and have no proper judicial support. Their men are unable to find work due to lack of identity cards and threats of intimidation by law enforcement agencies, forcing men to stay at their camps.
We have been living here peacefully since 2012. We came to save our lives, but the police and other agencies are usually coming to our camps for questioning, asking our IDs, and this has become a routine. We are terrified and we can't even sleep, thinking what would happen to us.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion, while the government describes them as security threat. Observers say the Rohingya refugees in particular have in the past and present been used largely for political reasons in this part of the world. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Yemenis have come together before the UN office in Sana'a to call on the international community to step in under pressure the Saudi-led coalition into releasing detained oil vessels. The detention of oil vessels has left the country in desperate struggle to survive amid a harsh shortage of fuel.
We have lots of problems amid fuel shortage. We stay here for days to get some liters of gasoline due to the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition and the continued detention of oil ships. We call on those who are after making concessions against the enemies to stand firm when it comes to the basic needs of Yemeni people.
Major sectors including health have warned that they may collapse in a few days if the detained oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition are not immediately released. Thousands of facilities have already stopped providing services due to a lack of fuel.
The situation today is entirely catastrophic, especially in the health sector. The petroleum company is unable to provide health facilities with the oil derivatives. 50 days have passed and not even a lease has been allowed to enter the port of Hodeidah. The U.S. and the U.N. bear responsibility of what is happening in Yemen.
The Saudi-led coalition is still holding 14 Yemeni oil ships illegally as they were inspected and authorized by the United Nations through verification and inspection mechanism. Hundreds of cars take days in long lines in front of the only working gas station in Sana'a. Yemenis say overcoming this dire situation needs a real action by the international community to step in and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
The prosecutor's office against hate crimes in Barcelona says it sees sufficient evidence to investigate Spain's far right for allegedly inciting hatred against Muslims following a complaint by several Muslim communities in Catalonia. At the core of the controversy is a video published online by the nativist ultra-nationalist party Vox during the recent election campaign in Catalonia.
The video falsely claims the entire Muslim community in Catalonia is responsible for the 2017 terrorist attacks in Barcelona. It purportedly shows footage of women in burqas in mosques that was actually shot in Afghanistan and other countries.
Vox's Twitter account was temporarily suspended at the end of January for breaching the company's hate speech regulations with false accusations and unfounded claims against Muslims in Catalonia.
Their strategy is to polarize society, to create fear and manipulate that fear in order to antagonize communities. This is an old mechanism that underlies all forms of racism. It alienates others by labeling them as foreigners. It goes back centuries in the Iberian Peninsula, and that is where you need to start in order to understand the rise of Islamophobia in Spain.
Vox won 11 seats in Catalonia's regional parliament. Their aggressive campaign against Muslims has raised awareness among community leaders to re-examine their alliances.
We regret the silence of political parties in Catalonia in this election. While they all wooed Muslim voters, not a single one had the courage to stand up and denounce the Islamophobic, xenophobic attacks against our country.
Although Catalonia is home to nearly 500,000 Muslims and has elected its first Muslim female member of parliament in 2017, it does not have a central cultural center or great mosque to this day. Unlike in previous suits against the far right, representatives of the Muslim community in Catalonia say they believe they have a solid case against Vox. They trust the courts will do them justice this time around. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, has just launched a new strategy designed to make the 27-nation bloc more assertive when it comes to trade policy. Apparently, the aggressive Trump era highlighted weaknesses in this area. During an online press conference, we asked the Commissioner in charge if EU firms will be able to trade with Iran
despite threats of penalties from the U.S. for doing so.
Against the illegal application of third country, illegal extraterritorial application of third country sanctions. For this we have a blocking statute which we are looking how to update it.
On Thursday, Charles Michel, who has a mandate to speak on behalf of the EU's 27 government leaders, held a phone conversation with the President of Iran, Hassan Rouhani. A statement issued on behalf of the European Council President says he told Rouhani the EU will continue to deploy efforts to facilitate the full implementation of the Iran nuclear agreement and America's return to the deal. Joe Biden has expressed his willingness to rejoin the 2015 international agreement, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The point has been made by numerous commentators. This is not about Biden giving indications or keeping promises. It's about the United States respecting international law. After all, the JCPOA is underpinned by a United Nations resolution. So far, however, Biden's administration has failed to take definitive action. The European Investment Bank has told us it will work with Iran once the conditions are right.
It means that, for example, the sanction policy has to be then different, and all the international agreements, you know, that we have to also adhere to, all that has to be sorted out before we can go and be active.
If Washington's illegal sanctions are lifted, Iran will be able to interact more freely with the EU across all industries, including energy.
The more supply there is, the weaker the prices in principle. So Iran being on the market both for oil and gas is good news for the consumers.
The EU is not shy about releasing statements, but it's unclear what concrete steps the bloc, as coordinator of the JCPOA, is taking to pull the US back into line. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This winter has seen food bank queues snaking around corners in the UK. Those down on their luck waiting up to 5 hours in the freezing cold, not knowing if there will be anything left for them. In places where poverty and hunger were already rife, it's the tip of the iceberg. Jaywick, a seaside village in southeast England, named the country's most deprived area for the past decade. Over the years, local authorities have been grilled over worsening conditions here to no avail. The council declined our request for an interview, but on Facebook, residents themselves were forthcoming. Maria responded to my post, saying her family and neighbours needed food. People here resent their Jaywick's shanty town status and are wary of outsiders. Reporters have tried to get interviews by offering them alcohol in the past. Drug and alcohol abuse are already a problem here. The government has given the local council millions of pounds to build a marketplace and affordable housing, but the locals say they're yet to feel the benefit of that.
I sort the landlords out and they do a bit of housing for people in Jaywick. I know they've built some new houses, but the trouble is the residents of Jaywick are not being offered the new housing.
They're not.
So it is, they're not clearing the crisis really, because there's a lot of people struggling in places with no heating and poor decorating.
These cottages used to be temporary holiday accommodation, but have served as permanent homes for decades now. They are run down and have little or no heating. There is no pressure on property owners to fix them either. Brenda has lived here for 31 years, and with her husband suffering from Alzheimer's, the food bank closing has only added to her woes. Supermarkets say they can't deliver to Jaywick. People are relying on community spirit to get them through. Half the children here live in poverty. Unemployment is high. For every five people, there's only one job. The British government stands accused of leaving it to charities to feed the country's hungry, millions of them children. NGOs say this is a comedown for the fifth largest economy in the world, and food bank queues growing because of the pandemic has only highlighted an already existing crisis. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Reports are emerging from ICE detention centers of solitary confinement cells with no heat and guards blasting fans at detainees complaining of cold, says Aline Brown, reporter, in an article published under the heading "Dying of Cold, ICE Detainees Freezing in Southern Prisons." Stay tuned, please. In Louisiana and Texas, immigrants seeking asylum are facing dire conditions in U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention centers, hit recently by extreme cold. At the South Texas Family Residential Center in Dilley, Texas, advocates say parents and children have been living with overflowing toilets, thirst, poor hygiene, and heat that fades in and out. 20 miles away at the South Texas ICE Processing Center in Pearsall, advocates say detainees who complained about the cold faced retaliation. At the Pine Prairie ICE Processing Center in Louisiana, a detainee interviewed by The Intercept reports that the segregation unit, akin to solitary confinement, has no heat. Lucia Allen, communications manager for the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services, known as RACES, has been in contact with Obaldo Oca Lopez, a father detained at the Pearsall facility located outside San Antonio. Although the ICE Processing Center, which is run by the private prison firm GEO Group, did not lose power, detainees were still left without sufficient heat. He said, "We are all really, really cold," Alan told The Intercept of her conversation with Oca Lopez. Detainees' complaints to ICE agents about the temperature have been met with retaliation, Oca Lopez told Allen. "The officers are turning on fans to make it colder," Allen said. "If they are hearing complaints like, 'Oh, it's cold in here,' they will be like, 'It could be worse,' and turn on fans." Oca Lopez told her that agents have thrown blankets into garbage after detainees' complaint. "The situation heightened fears that the cold will leave people vulnerable to COVID-19 in a unit that houses around 90 people. ICE detention centers have been racked with coronavirus infections, in part thanks to the nature of the close quarters. Detainees, advocates, and whistleblowers have also reported mismanagement and medical neglect. Oco Lopez told Allen that the tension has at times spilled over into detainees fighting over the insufficient blankets. IC officials deny there is a problem with heat at the Pearsall facility. Temperature checks at Pearsall showed that all areas of the facility were on average 70 degrees and within the acceptable range of 69 to 76 degrees, a spokesperson told The Intercept over email. Immigration advocates are accustomed to ICE denying problems exist. First, we had the mistreatment and separation of families. Then we came into COVID with people getting sick in these facilities. Now, we have this whole other situation happening, said Allen. She noted that many of the detainees in these centers could be paroled into U.S. as they awaited asylum and other immigration rulings. So far, the Biden administration had failed to take action. In Texas, there is no move from this administration to release these families. ICE's Pine Prairie, Louisiana Detention Center, the system of punishment for detainees, became much more severe with the cold. Angel Argueta Anariba, who is detained there, told The Intercept that although other parts of the facility have heat, the segregation unit does not. Argueta Anariba was placed in an individual segregation cell a few days before the cold set in, a situation he describes as retaliatory. Argueta Anariba has a health condition that calls for special diet. For months, he has pressured the various ICE facilities to which he has been transferred to fulfill his dietary requirements, to no avail. He said the Pine Prairie administration's explanation for placing him in segregation that he destroyed government property is completely false. Rather, he believes it was retaliation for the continued pressure he has put on the institution to give him the correct meals. Pine Prairie was recently accused of other retaliatory efforts. The Intercept reported recently that a guard at a private prison had threatened detainees with being put into coronavirus ward if they did not submit to deportation orders. For Argueta Anariba, the typical stresses of isolated confinement were unexpectedly compounded by the cold. Although detainees in segregation are in individual cells, Argueta Anariba was able to speak to the others through the walls. There is no heat, there is nothing. We were eight people dying of cold, he said. Argueta Anariba said he put on three pairs of pants and three shirts and stayed wrapped in his sheets in his bed all the day. He said that meals would arrive cold by the time they got to the cell. His bones ached. I'm asthmatic, he said. On Sunday, I had terrible chest pain. Though the freezing weather arrived on Friday, Argueta Anariba said it wasn't until Sunday that he was offered an extra blanket. Recently, he was released back into a regular heated unit, a move he says could have happened sooner to protect him from the cold. IC officials told The Intercept that although Pine Prairie made use of a generator on Wednesday and the facility never lost heat or power, IC facilities in Louisiana are experiencing weather-related impacts that mirror the local community. However, all IC facilities have backup generator power, a spokesperson said. All facilities have also implemented contingency plans developed in anticipation of severe winter weather. The assessment did not match Argueta Anariba experience. There are seven people still in those conditions. To leave people in those conditions is inhumane. families freeze in Texas. IC has the power to allow detainees to leave facilities that have become increasingly dangerous, said Natalie Lerner, a paralegal with Proyecto Dili, a pro bono legal services provider for detainees at a South Texas Family Residential Center. In our view, they should pretty seriously consider releasing everybody, she said. It seems like the conditions aren't very safe. The pandemic is of particular concern. What has been on my mind is the folks we work with that have pre-existing issues who are already vulnerable because of COVID-19, and this is further threatening their health, she said. Families she works with inside the South Texas Family Residential Center, which is managed by private prison company CoreCivic, report that since Sunday, the heat and electricity have periodically shut down at times for long stretches. Over the weekend, the water was cut off and toilets overflowed. With no means to flush, the shared toilets became more and more full, Lerner said. Parents and children were given one bottle of water in the morning to get them through the day. They were left wearing the same clothes for days on end. As of Thursday, blackouts and problems with water continued. With phone services cutting, a sense of isolation has set in. One client I have been working with who has a wife in the facility, they are detained separately. She has a lot of medical concerns, Lerner said. He has been really, really worried about her. She added that there is a huge amount of worry for parents for their kids. We have heard people saying kids are getting sick because of how cold it is, she said. People are expressing a lot of desperation. Again, IC officials denied the advocate's reports. Like most of Texas, IC facilities in Texas have had to deal with intermittent power outages and interruptions in water service. However, all IC facilities have backup generator power, a spokesperson said. Toilets at South Texas FRC are not overflowing. Residents of the South Texas FRC did experience interruptions in water service for a couple of days, like most of Texas, but it was restored recently. No facilities are rationing water bottles, and they have plenty of water bottles. Across the border in Matamoros, asylum seekers, including families with children, have suffered the cold weather at a refugee camp that emerged in response to President Donald Trump's anti-immigration policies. The Migration Protection Protocols, known as the Remain in Mexico policy, forced many asylum seekers to wait for their asylum hearings on the Mexico side of the border. Although President Joe Biden ended the program, the asylum seekers have not yet been processed. Although the extreme weather is certainly to blame for much of the misery in IC detention centers this month, many of the conditions precede the storms. Even in areas accustomed to cold, the immigration agency's detention centers have a reputation for failing to keep people warm in cold weather.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says Iran will never renegotiate the JCPOA and that the United States must rescind all sanctions in order to return to the agreement. He added that the U.S. must make the move because it is the country which left the agreement in the first place. This at the same time that the IAEA chief is visiting Iran. Tehran is set to stop its voluntary cooperation, allowing IAEA snap inspection in 2 days. Stay with us as we take a look at what all this means in this debate.
The clock is ticking as the Iranian government is preparing to implement a parliamentary law to cease the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The protocol calls for unannounced inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency of Iran's nuclear sites. Those snap inspections will now be suspended when the Iranian legislation comes into force Tuesday. The move is the latest step Iran has taken in response to the failure of the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal to fulfill their commitments. Iran had demanded the Europeans make up for the 2018 US withdrawal from the deal and its reimposition of sanctions. In an exclusive interview with Press TV, Iran's top diplomat said the law is in line with the nuclear agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA.
This is what we can do in accordance with paragraph 36 of the JCPOA, which enables Iran to take remedial action against failure by other members of the JCPOA to implement their obligations.
Zarif also slammed the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden for continuing the policy of sanctions against Iran.
The problem is, U.S. is addicted to sanctions. U.S. is addicted to pressure. U.S. is addicted to bullying.
And this is his stance over Washington's return to the JCPOA.
Well, the United States will not be able to rejoin the JCPOA before they remove the sanctions.
Zarif added that Iran will seek compensation after Washington rejoins the nuclear deal.
Commit, act, meet. First we need commitment. We haven't seen it. Then we need action, removal of sanctions. Then we will meet. When we meet, we will raise compensation. We have lost about $1,000 billion, $1 trillion, at least directly and indirectly, because of imposition of U.S. sanctions since 2018.
Crippling economic sanctions.
Zarif took a jab at the U.S. for its so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by former President Donald Trump. The Iranian foreign minister said the campaign targeting his country has been a failure. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told the BBC on Friday that the policy has produced no results. Now, it's up to the White House to go ahead with a failed policy or reverse course in dealing with Iran.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate out of London, historian and journalist Marcus Papadopoulos, also an author, and out of New York, Frederick Peterson, Senior U.S. Congressional Defense Advisor. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start off with Marcus. Your take on what is going on right now. We know that the IAEA chief is here in Iran at this time, perhaps trying to get some type of compromise, although the Iranian side is abided by law now to actually back away from the cooperation of voluntarily allowing those snap inspections. Your take on the possible effect of this, and what do you think that the IAEA at this point in time expects from Tehran?
I think I should first of all say that irrespective of whether a Republican or Democrat is sitting in the White House, the core objective of American foreign policy will always remain the same. And that core objective is centered on preserving the American empire and strengthening the American empire. preserving and strengthening by all means necessary, including economic warfare and also military invasions. And a country such as Iran, which is in an extremely geostrategic part of the world and pursues an independent foreign policy, will always be a target for American foreign policy makers. Now, turning to the JCPOA, the Americans left the deal. The Europeans have remained steadfast in their commitment to the deal. However, the Europeans have not compensated for the American withdrawal. As regards Iran, the Iranians have complied with every agreement laid out in the JCPOA. So, if the Americans, under Joe Biden, wish to return to the JCPOA, the onus is on them and them only to lift the sanctions, the severe sanctions that America placed on Iran under Donald Trump. Because Iran has, as I said, complied fully with the Iran nuclear deal. And secondly, Iran is a self-respecting country. America left the agreement, therefore, America, for America to return, it has to lift those sanctions. But alas, the Americans will not lift those sanctions. Why? Because America, whether America is led by someone like Donald Trump or someone like Joe Biden, is committed to destroying the Iranian revolution, to subjugating the Iranian people, and to returning Iran to how it was during the days of the Shah.
Okay, stay with me, Marcus.
Vassal state of
Washington. Stay with me. I would definitely pick up on a few points you've made, but let me get our other guest, Frederick, in on this conversation. Frederick, you heard what Marcus said, that basically it doesn't make a difference if it's a Trump administration or a Biden administration, Republican or Democrat. Basically, the goal is to continue the empire no matter what the stakes are. So that basically what he's saying is that the United States really does not want the existence of the Islamic Republic, and that's the root of the problem. Your take?
Well, the good professor shows a profound misunderstanding, either correct. There's a feedback here, but at any rate, what he does is speaks of American empire. There is no such thing as American empire. America is the antithesis of empire. The American ideal is what is offered to the world, and American preservation and protection of the freedom that we have and that our allies have, and that the freedom to which all people aspire around the world. Now, that is not for export. It is for protection. By that I mean it is not to be imposed. You don't impose freedom upon others, but you protect others that reach up for their freedom and request, and you certainly protect your own.
Okay, now, Frederick, wait, there's a whole lot. I have to stop you. I have to stop you, Frederick. There's a whole lot that you have just said. Hopefully you don't have too much feedback, yes, that you can hear certainly me right now. When you talk about that, to protect your own and freedom, and
you can't
enforce freedom on others. I mean, we're getting on a totally different topic than a JCPOA, but I have to jump in here with, let me just say, when I talked to the Iranian foreign minister today, Mohammad Javad Zarif, he talked about $1 trillion in damage, the very least financially, for the United States. Basically, the Obama and the Trump administration basically not living up to their agreement. So where's the freedom? Where's the fairness? Where is basically abiding by its agreements that you're talking about this United States in that way?
Well, my first remark was to address a remark that the other guest said. However, let me say that I and the Iranian government and the people around the world should aspire to the development of peaceful use of nuclear power development, particularly because it is a magnificent generator of power at a very low price, a very low cost to the environment. And Iran has lost a tremendous amount of assets, both time, money, and power in having their project delayed. If this project, the bottom line here is, if this project to develop nuclear power for peaceful use in Iran is the legitimate means for the nuclear discussions that we're having, they will find a ready, willing, and able partner, both in the previous administration, they would have, and they will, I am confident, in this administration. But the big but is that nuclear power may have multiple uses, some which are not peaceful. And if those multiple uses that are outside the grounds of the JCPOA are not in the intention of Iran or any other government, then put them on the table.
Okay.
Have legitimate means
Frederick,
of inspection
wait a minute,
to
Frederick.
Ensure those who
Frederick,
are
Frederick,
who are
we
less,
are getting on a totally, excuse me,
that
you're getting on a totally different topic. We're talking
peaceful
about
use.
The JCPOA that's already been negotiated, already been agreed to, already the United States accepted
yes.
this. We're talking about that, and then you're saying that they have to put it on the table. Iran hasn't left the JCPOA. Iran didn't actually lived up to its agreements. We're talking about Washington that hasn't lived up to its agreements. Let me turn to Marcus. Marcus, there just seems to be a very hegemonic perspective that comes out of Washington and its supporters when dealing with a country like Iran, when dealing with a country that is standing up for its independence. So your perspective in general, how does a country or an independent country actually, when in dealing with an entity like the United States, how can it even guarantee any type of agreement? Because we saw what happened with this 2015 agreement. Even the Obama administration from the beginning did not implement it in the way that they said they did. So it's not just Trump, it's Obama, it's Trump, and now it's Biden.
Well, first of all, let me say that the analysis put forward by the American guest constituted nothing more than simple-minded analysis, and I should also add, very peculiar analysis. Perhaps he should visit the slave markets in Tripoli, Libya, and tell the sub-Saharan slaves there about American freedom. Perhaps he should take a visit to Damascus or another Syrian city and sit down with the families who have lost husbands or sons or brothers to ISIS and Al-Qaeda, terrorist groups which were armed and trained and financed by the American government. Now, returning to the matter in hand, the Iran nuclear deal, there is nothing more that Iran can do as regards complying with this deal. As I said moments ago, the onus is completely with the American government. If the American government wants to return to it, then it needs to rescind the sanctions that Trump placed on Iran. Because why should a country which initially signed up to agreement and then left the agreement be allowed to return if its presence to the agreement is detrimental? The situation has changed dramatically concerning the JCPOA since it came into force in 2015. And you ask me about how Iran can respond to America. Well, Iran knows how to respond to American aggression. The Iranian people have been strengthening their country for 42 years now since the Iranian Revolution. And Iran in 2021 is at its most strongest. Iran today enjoys a strategic partnership with Russia. Therefore, Iran is even in a more better position to say to the Americans, if you do not do this, then you do not return to the Iran nuclear deal. And what are the Americans going to do? The Americans will simply attempt to asphyxiate the Iranian economy. The Americans will keep on increasing their military presence in the Persian Gulf. The Americans will continue arming MEK terrorists in Albania and helping to facilitate their arrival into Iran or close to Iranian borders. So nothing is really going to change. I only wish the Europeans would show more of a backbone and help to ensure that the JCPOA is able to survive and survive in the long term.
Well, let me pick up right there. Frederick, what's your take about the European side of things? Because we saw the United States actually leaving the JCPOA, and we saw the Europeans basically giving in to America's bullying and not allowing actually their companies to deal freely with Iran. Your take on the European side of things right now with the JCPOA agreement. Can the Europeans act individually as independent countries, or basically do they have to acquiesce to whatever Washington tells them to do?
Well, let me add a very simple comment to your previous guest's assertion of that he prefers simplicity, apparently. I'm an American Marine. I've been in spirit and in brotherhood to Tripoli from sea to shining sea. We know what it is to assist people who are laboring under oppression. However, this JCPOA is not about oppression. It's about, and should be about, and at its heart is about the delivery of power to people. I'm talking about nuclear power at a market price that will be elevating to the entire region and to all. To claim that Iran now suddenly has Russia as an ally is not an asset that you bring to the table. It's a subliminal threat saying that Iran has become a vassal of Russian foreign policy and now is cooperating to do what precisely? We are talking about a good faith reach to develop power for a country and a region that is safe, affordable, clean, and efficient. And we are willing to help. You will find even this administration, which has certainly some fundamental differences with the previous, there is an opportunity, both in the past and in the future, for a good faith reaching for this development to make the JCPOA work with the proper inspections, the proper motivation on both sides, I should say, not to impose anything upon Iran, but to expect from Iran full cooperation and inspections that will guarantee the security of their people, of the region, and of the
Frederick,
world. This
then,
is not too much to
well,
ask.
Frederick,
it's,
let
it's
me.
A natural
well, Frederick,
expectation.
Hopefully you can hear me.
So,
you're not having any extra noise in your ear. Frederick, stay with me. I want to ask you then. When you talk about extra, as far as Iran cooperating, and of course we know that Iran has been cooperating, Iran has gone beyond actually its responsibility with the JCPOA, and that's what we're talking about with the IAEA chief here now. Basically, Iran is going to back off of some of that extra cooperation, for example, letting them have snap inspections whenever they wanted, IAEA inspectors. It really wasn't part of the JCPOA, but you talked about as far as regional security. What about Israel? Why doesn't the United States talk about Israel that has nuclear bombs that no one is actually inspecting them? If the United States is really worried about regional security, then what about Tel Aviv? Marcus, I only have about a minute. Your overall take on where this is going with this JCPOA, with the perspective that the United States has and basically the Europeans giving in to Washington, what has to give? Where do you see it going?
America will not rescind the Trump-era sanctions on Iran. America will continue its policy of attempting to undermine the Iranian revolution in the hope that Iran will one day be a client state of Washington's, as it was under the Shah. And at the same time, Iran will remain the strong country it has become economically and militarily as a result of the Iranian revolution. As regards to the guest in America, I would have more respect for him if he simply came out and said that he wishes to see countries such as Cuba, Venezuela, and Iran subjugated by the American Empire. The fact that he doesn't means I don't have an ounce of respect either for him or for his views. And as regards the Israelis, well, perhaps he would like to explain his stance on how Israel openly treated, wounded Al-Qaeda terrorists in Israeli military hospitals. Al-Qaeda terrorists who not only massacred Syrian civilians, but massacred Americans in New York on 9/11. How does he feel about Israel having treated those wretched, diabolical human beings? Perhaps he can answer that.
Okay, well, unfortunately, it has to be on another show because we are out of time. Appreciate both of you being with us on this debate. Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, journalist, and author. Out of London, Frederick Peterson, senior U.S. Congressional Defense Advisor, out of New York. And as always, viewers, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marcia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you right here next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.